We are talking once again with Joff Perich and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's been a wild week with actually at least one piece of good news in it. So perhaps we should start with that, specifically Compassion Seattle's.
Charter Amendment 29. Yeah.
Yes.
On Friday, just yesterday, if you're listening to this on Saturday, King County Superior Court Judge Christine Schaffer ruled that Charter Amendment 29 should be pulled from the November ballot. She ruled against the Compassion Seattle initiative to force the city of Seattle to spend 12% of its budget to build 2,000 new shelter beds with wraparound services in 2022, next year, and would enshrine homeless encampment sweeps in the city charter for the next 6 years. Charter Amendment 29 also would require the city to waive certain land use and zoning codes to speed up the construction of new shelters. Now, Judge Schaffer agreed with opponents of the initiative that no ballot measure can overrule the city government's authority to determine its own policies on homelessness and land use and determine how the money in the city budget is spent. That authority is granted to the mayor and the city council by the state legislature and by state law, and that authority can't be overturned by a local initiative. Now, Judge Schaffer also agreed that the initiative would interfere with the city's decision to move its homelessness services to the new King County Regional Homelessness Authority. That's an administrative decision that can't be overturned through a vote on a local initiative. Schaffer said the decision was not even close, and that there are many, many prior state Supreme Court decisions on this topic that would invalidate Charter Amendment 29. Schaffer herself is not an opponent of Charter Amendment 29. In fact, she said in open court that she would be likely to vote for it if it was on the ballot. But because it clearly violates the limits of what local initiatives can do under state law, she had to pull it from the ballot. Compassion Seattle is not appealing the decision to the state Supreme Court, since there's really not enough time between now and the November election for them to get a ruling. King County Elections needs to start printing ballots by September 9th so that ballots can be mailed to overseas voters and to military voters who then need the time to be able to get them mailed back within a reasonable period.
Underscores the importance of the city council decision to put it on the November ballot rather than to put it in a special election early next year, which is what Compassion Seattle sponsors originally wanted.
Now, Compassion Seattle has said that instead of pushing to try to get it back on the ballot, they're going to be putting their time and money into getting Bruce Harrell elected for mayor, Ann Davison elected for city attorney, and Sarah Nelson for city council position 9. So we can expect them to be doing a lot more organizing and possibly trying to get further endorsements for people like Bruce Harrell and Ann Davison.
And that really tells you where the sponsors were coming from. Mm-hmm. They're very much with the business community. They're very much with the tough on law enforcement, and they really did not have the best interests of the homeless community in mind when they drafted that.
No. So that's the news on Charter Amendment 29. That's good news for progressives in the city of Seattle, because Charter Amendment 29 would have complicated things considerably in terms of Seattle politics making decisions on the budget and trying to figure out exactly whose responsibility it is to deal with homelessness, whether it's still the city of Seattle's or whether it's really in the bailiwick now of the regional authority.
You have to wonder why the organizers of Compassion Seattle didn't see this coming. You know, with the $1 million they dropped on this campaign so far that we know of?
I don't think they see it as a lost issue, because Compassion Seattle has gotten a lot of publicity for Charter Amendment 29. And just being out in the community and talking about it and getting people riled up about homelessness, I think they really see that as feeding into electing their favored candidates for mayor and city attorney and city council.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's really disingenuous to say from their standpoint that they're going to be supporting those three candidates when you knew they were going to be supporting those three candidates to begin with. You know, it just wasn't.
Yeah, but someone like Tim Burgess has been putting a lot of his I'm picking on Tim Burgess in particular because he's been the major spokesman behind Charter Amendment 29. He's been putting a lot of his time and energy into that process. And now he can turn that time and energy over to working on Bruce Harrell's campaign. He's one of the leading donors to Bruce Harrell's campaign. If you go to the Seattle Ethics and Elections website and you look at a list of contributors, he's right up there having given, you know, $550 along with a whole bunch of other, you know, real estate developers and, you know, venture fund capitalists and all sorts of folks who are movers and shakers and wealthy people in Seattle. Now he can also devote his volunteer time and his considerable experience and his long, long list of contacts for raising money for campaigns from when he was running for city council. So that's not a small thing. I should point out too that, you know, our history with initiatives here locally is that Tim Iman comes along and drafts an initiative that, you know, does something that, you know, initiative that does more than one thing or focuses on more than one topic or kind of breaks the rules in a way that's very different from this. This is, I think, probably the first time we've had a court ruling on an initiative that says, nope, sorry, this is something that initiatives can't do. You know, it's not this violates the laws regarding, you know, how initiatives should be drafted. Kind of a basic, you know, this guy wrote this initiative, but he didn't understand, you know, how initiatives should be drafted. That's Tim Iman. Whereas here it's, you know, these folks wrote this initiative and they really didn't understand that state law takes precedence here. That's a different decision. And that's kind of interesting to me. It really shows you, I think, a little bit the thinking behind someone like Tim Burgess, who thinks that, well, you know, I'm kind of above state law, right?
Well, I think they had enough money that I'm sure they had lawyers vet the initiative before they submitted it. Mm-hmm. And in all likelihood, they thought that they could throw enough money into their legal fight to win it.
And skate on that.
Yeah.
So.
But didn't work out that way.
Because money buys everything, right?
Right. Didn't work out that way. Or maybe they were gambling that even if the decision was against them, it wouldn't happen till after it was passed in the election. And then it would be a moot point whether the initiative was legal or not, because the voters would have sent a clear signal to the city and then they could put more pressure on making changes. You know, and maybe they were thinking there would be this great victory come November. The charter amendment would pass. Harrell would become mayor and they would get their other favored candidates into office too in one big sweep. So there's always that.
Yeah. Shall we move on to the 55 minutes of bad news?
Yeah, let's move over to local housing news.
Yeah, Kevin Schofield of the blog Seattle City Council Insight pointed out this week that the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn the Center for Disease Control's federal eviction moratorium could endanger local eviction bans. Just a really quick update on the national case. The Supreme Court ruled that the CDC doesn't have the broad authority to issue an eviction moratorium, although it can order specific limited measures in a public health emergency, things like pest removal, fumigation, sanitation, etc. An eviction moratorium, because it's more broad and because it has a much wider impact on the economy and on landlords and property owners, The Supreme Court ruled that Congress would need to pass a law to institute a formal eviction ban, and Congress hasn't done it. So here in the state of Washington, there's a case challenging our state eviction ban. It doesn't argue that the governor or mayor of Seattle doesn't have the authority to issue a ban. Instead, what it argues is that the eviction ban violates clauses of the Constitution. It impairs contracts under the Contracts Clause, in this case, lease agreements, and it's a takings of property under the Fifth Amendment. Now, the Contracts Clause argument is not a strong one and has been overturned recently in a challenge to Los Angeles's eviction ban. But the second argument, there are aspects to the Supreme Court's ruling that could affect that second takings argument. The Supreme Court decision says, quote, the moratorium has put the applicants, along with millions of landlords across the country, at risk of irreparable harm by depriving them of rent payments with no guarantee of eventual recovery. Despite the CDC's determination that landlords should bear a significant financial cost of the pandemic, many landlords have modest means, and preventing them from evicting tenants who breach their leases intrudes on one of the most fundamental elements of property ownership, the right to exclude. And the right to exclude is one of the tests of takings under the Fifth Amendment. So it appears that Schofield may be right about this. There's a lot more to his analysis of how the Supreme Court decision would impact our state and local eviction ban. And I think if you really want to understand the full argument, I would invite you to check it out at his blog, sccinsight.com. And notably, parts of his analysis point out that the remedy for unlawful takings by the government is adequate compensation to the property owner, in this case, the landlords. So an eviction ban in which the landlord can't secure compensation from their tenants could mean that the city and state governments are on the hook to pay back rent instead of the tenants, and not just through the limited rental assistance programs we've seen so far. So that could definitely influence Governor Inslee and Mayor Durkin to end the eviction bans sooner instead of extending them from September 30th, which is when they currently are set to expire, to the year end, which is when activists are urging them to extend the bans to. So I think that that's kind of a significant issue, that we may see them let the eviction moratoriums expire on September 30th, if not end them sooner, saying, hey, Supreme Court decided, you know, if it really is takings, then we need to, we can't, the city and state governments can't afford to compensate landlords, you know.
You know, 20 years ago, the idea of takings was a lunatic far-right libertarian legal concept.
Shows now you how far the courts have come, yeah.
Yes, yeah, it's become mainstream, which is disgusting.
Yeah. Now, the other thing I want to talk about in local housing news is another article that I want to recommend this week. An interesting post appeared on Erica Barnett's blog, publicola.com, and I think it was written by Erica. It looks at the reasons why the city of Seattle hasn't spent the money that the city council budgeted last year to build 12 new tiny house villages. And the answer is that the city is turning over its homelessness services to the King County Regional Authority, and Mark Dones, who is running the authority, doesn't like tiny house villages. So the regional authority is barely underway, and there's already a major conflict going on with the city of Seattle. It boils down to what the priorities should be: either build housing ASAP, that's Mark Dones' position, or get people out of tents ASAP, that's council member Andrew Lewis's position, and he's the chair of the Special Committee on Homelessness at the city council. Dones appears to be unwilling to look at the data that says tiny home villages have a much better track record at getting people placed into housing than congregate emergency shelters. He's worried that tiny house villages will become parking lots for homeless people instead of moving them into fully functioning permanent housing. Now, at the same time, Seattle provides most of the funding for the Regional Homelessness Authority, so Dones may have to change his mind about this if the city council puts enough pressure on him, and if they get a mayor elected who is willing to go along with that. currently Mayor Durkin has been slow walking a lot of the council's priorities in the budget. And so there's money sitting there unspent for plenty of things. Emergency shelter is one of them, particularly emergency shelter in hotel rooms because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the other one now is money for these 12 tiny home villages. So that's my update.
That's a lot of tiny home villages that are sitting in limbo.
It is, and it's a lot of help that could be going out to people who are living in tents. And the weather's pretty nice right now, but it's getting cooler out at night, and winter is coming. Tiny homes may not be as good as permanent shelter or permanent housing, but they're way better than living in a tent.
Yeah, or living under a bridge.
Yeah, or sleeping in a doorway.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of efforts by local organizations and individuals for building those tiny houses. I have to imagine a lot of those are also sitting in limbo, mm-hmm. you know, waiting to be moved to specific locations where they can have occupancy.
Yeah, well, you know, Sharon Lee at Lehigh, the Low Income Housing Institute, she's one of the key players in all this, and she's been trying to navigate, you know, who do we get the sign off on these things for, you know, because it's not as straightforward as it used to be. You just apply to the City of Seattle and you'd fill out the paperwork, you'd get the permits, you'd get them up and running. Well, now there's two agencies you have to deal with, and it's not clear who's governing what right now. So she's got to kind of navigate that and figure out, okay, who do I give the paperwork to? Who gets the sign off? Does the Regional Homelessness Authority get it first? Does the city get it first? Do they have to communicate? You know, what's the procedure? And that's part of the issue, I'm sure, is developing the procedure and trying to figure out when you've got one of those bodies saying, nope, we're not doing it, then that puts a kibosh on the whole thing. So that's where they stand right now, is currently deadlocked in an argument over whether or not those funds should be spent on tiny home villages. The city council has voted yes to do it. You know, the mayor signed off on that budget, but the Regional Homelessness Authority is like, nope, all of our resources should go into building permanent housing, which is, you know, years down the road, right? You don't build permanent housing overnight, and certainly not within the same time frame of putting up a tiny home village.
Well, let's move on to election updates and who's raised money.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of revisit who's raised how much money in the various races in the city. In the mayor's race, Bruce Harrell has raised a total of $629,248 for his campaign. The largest source is from outside the city limits. That's 19% of his contributions. Another 34% comes evenly from two districts, District 7, which is downtown Belltown, Queen Anne and Magnolia, and District 3, the pricey homes along the top of Capitol Hill and along Lake Washington and Madrona Park. Okay. Only 9% of his contributions are in the range of less than $100. The biggest chunk, 37%, are from $100 to $199. And he's received a lot of democracy vouchers. About 41% of his contributions are from democracy vouchers. But
interestingly, the two districts that seem to be funding his campaign do not include his old district of Southeast Seattle.
No, they do not. That would be District 2. Now, the second largest chunk of his contributions, 34%, are folks giving him between $500 to $599. Those contributions are obviously coming from a lot of local wealthy folks, real estate executives, and local movers and shakers. Lorena Gonzalez, on the other hand, has raised $539,128. Her district pie chart has much more even pie slices. And about 12% of her funds are from outside the city limits, so less than for Bruce Harrell. 32% of her contributions are under $100. That's pretty amazing, I think, for someone running for mayor. And 35% are $100 to $199. So altogether in those two lowest categories, that's two-thirds of her contributions right there. About 21% of her contributions are folks giving between $500 to $599, so less than a quarter of right there. A lot of those higher cash contributions are coming from folks in the legal profession. Gonzalez worked as a practicing attorney before she ran for city council, and she has extensive contacts in the legal community. But she also has a lot of donations from folks who work for unions. And for nonprofits like the Northwest Immigration Rights Project and the Nature Conservancy, for example. 64% of her contributions are from democracy vouchers, so that's higher than Bruce Harrell's 41%. Now, their political action campaigns. Bruce Harrell's Harrell for Seattle's Future has raised $346,415 and has spent all but $32,500 of that. Its contributors are primarily real estate executives and real estate investment companies. So, you know, that and that's kind of interesting. If you look at the pop-up list of contributors, it's just all the major players in the real estate industry in Seattle. The PAC for Gonzalez, Essential Workers for Lorena, has raised $451,676, so more than Bruce Harrell's PAC. And it's spent all but $4,800 of that. Its contributors are all just a handful of local unions. So adding the total of each candidate's campaign to their PAC money that's operating on their behalf, Harrell has about $975,663 to Gonzalez's $990,804. So it's pretty even. But again, the race isn't over yet. So things could change here in the last couple months.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So now if we look over at Council Position 9, Sarah Nelson is leading in the fundraising with $288,450. Like Harrell, her biggest source of funding are biggest sources of funding are District 7 with 19% of her contributions, District 3 with 16%, and outside the city limits with 16%. Districts 4 in Northeast Seattle and 6 in Northwest Seattle make up 14% and 13% respectively, and she has negligible amounts from Districts 1, 2, and 5, where more low-income folks live. So again, 1 is West Seattle and south to the city limits, 2 is Southeast Seattle, and 5 is up in North Seattle around, you know, Lake City and so forth. Those are further out from the city core, so rental and housing prices are a little bit lower there, and more lower income folks live in those three districts. When we look at contributions by size, 58% of Sarah Nelson's contributions are from $500 to $599. So if there's one thing that Sarah Nelson really excels at, it's rubbing elbows with the rich. Now, her opponent, Nikita Oliver, has raised $202,090 and probably an additional $80,000 in democracy vouchers that are not in that total. So they're not far behind Nelson. Their pie slices are looking more even than they were, but Oliver is still getting the largest number of their donations from districts 2 and 3. Again, 2 is Southeast Seattle, and then district 3 is Capitol Hill. And there are portions of Capitol Hill that are still low income. But they are raising more money now from other districts, and that's a good sign. Oliver's percentage of donations from outside Seattle is 8%, the second lowest in any race. The lowest is Nicole Thomas Kennedy, who only has 3% of her donations from outside Seattle. 66%, or almost two-thirds of Oliver's donations, are under $200, okay? And 50% of their total contributions so far are from democracy vouchers, which means that there are a lot of people who are giving Oliver cash, as well as their democracy vouchers, which is a good sign for their campaign. Now, Sarah Nelson is not collecting democracy vouchers because she didn't want to be limited by how much money she could take from each of the wealthy donors she's tapping in that race. So there's a very strong division there between who is supporting who in that race.
Income-wise.
Now, for city attorney, the other race that's in question, I'm not going to look at council position 8, where Teresa Mosqueda is largely unopposed by her opponent. For city attorney, Nicole Thomas Kennedy is well ahead in contributions with $205,640. 49% of her contributions are from districts 2 and 3, with the rest coming almost evenly from districts 4, 5, 6, and 7. Good sign for her candidacy as well. She only has, as I said, 3% from outside the city limits. 98% of her contributions are under $200. Okay, I'm going to say that again. 98% of her contributions are under $200. So she is truly running a campaign of small donors, right? Because those donations under $200 is the $100 to $199. People could give her all of their democracy vouchers and they'd be donating $100 to her campaign, right? So she's truly running a campaign of small donors. 90% of her contributions are democracy vouchers. Okay. I've never seen that. That's amazing. Now on the other side, again, a very big division here between who is supporting who in this race. For Ann Davison, she has raised $55,841, about a quarter of what Thomas Kennedy has raised, mostly from districts 4, 5, 6, and 7, but all of the districts that cover the kind of the core of Seattle, but mostly skewing northward. So 4, 5, and 6 are all North Seattle, and 7 is downtown, Belltown, Queen Anne, and Magnolia, right? But her largest source is 20% from outside the city limits. Okay. The highest percentage for any candidate in this election. 63% of her contributions are over $200. So she's not as successful as Sarah Nelson at rubbing elbows with rich people, but she's still no slouch, right? She does not appear to be collecting democracy vouchers at all. So. Very big division there between Thomas Kennedy's donors and Ann Davison's donors.
It's because Ann Davison doesn't believe in democracy.
That's right.
as a member of the modern Republican Party.
Yeah. she would not agree with that, but I think I would. So that's my rundown on who's raised how much money and from whom and in what form.
Wow. Yeah, and again, after the Compassion Seattle developments yesterday, it's going to be a very interesting race.
It's going to be really interesting now to see those folks who are working hard on the Charter Amendment 29 campaign, if they pivot now to working more on behalf of these candidates, how much more money is going to flood into the field. We got about 9 weeks until the election, and ballots are going to get mailed in September.
And do you have an idea how much cash on hand Compassion Seattle has? Because that can be diverted into raises of candidates they're endorsing as well.
I didn't look at the Compassion Seattle information on the Seattle Ethics and Elections website, but I would invite anybody who's listening to the show to Google Seattle Ethics and Elections and to look at the campaigns. You want to look at the campaigns page and I don't know, they may list it under who's running for, you know, or they may list them as campaigns, and you can click on each one and just kind of dive into what you see there, the statistics and the money and how much each candidate has spent. And you can even click open their reports that they submitted to see what they actually have been spending their money on, who's using the internet, who's mailing out a ton of campaign flyers, who's paying interns to fire off an email every 2 or 3 days, like Bruce Harrell's campaign is doing, you know? that can be kind of fun to look at.
Yeah, it's a remarkably helpful resource.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I actually thought I saw a tweet yesterday regarding Compassion Seattle, and that they were at least six figures in the red currently. So I think they're going to be passing the hat.
Yes, and campaigns can go in. Yeah, campaigns can go into debt. They can spend more money than they have on hand. That's what city attorney candidate Pete Holmes had done. He had about $5,000 or $6,000 that he had spent but didn't actually have in his campaign fund. And so he ended up, after he withdrew from the race, he ended up sending out a couple of email blasts saying, "Hey guys, I'm raising money to retire the debt on my campaign."
Yeah. And I've never entirely understand that, because most vendors for political campaigns will demand cash up front. Because they know that after the election is over, or if the candidate loses, they're going to have a very hard time collecting.
Yeah, many vendors do. There are some candidates that pay staff, though. And sometimes they end up having to pay them out of pocket or dismissing them without payment if they don't have the money to pay them for the last week or two of their work. So good candidates try to do that. They try to pay their staff for their last couple weeks of work.
Yeah.
I would hope.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on to this week's COVID news.
Oi. Well, we set a new record yesterday for daily new cases in the state of Washington, 4,299. And in King County, we were well over 800 as well for new cases. Most local hospitals are at capacity, according to the Washington Hospital Association. So the pandemic is very much with us. If you haven't been vaccinated, for God's sakes, get vaccinated. Whether you're vaccinated or not, wear a mask when you're outside or inside in public spaces. Anywhere in a public space, really, because the Delta variant is far more contagious, it's turning out, than was understood at first. And it's creating problems all over the U.S., but particularly in the Pacific Northwest as well as in the South. You're not as hearing as much about it, and I really don't understand why. It should be getting a lot more local coverage than it is.
I'd like to say, over the last week in Washington State, one new person every hour was admitted to a hospital for COVID-19 treatment, okay? And the bulk of those people are unvaccinated or not fully vaccinated. So if you're doing the Pfizer or the Moderna shot, you got to get your second shot. Your first shot is not going to protect you, and it probably won't protect you from getting serious COVID-19.
Yeah.
Most of those folks are from age 25 to 49 years old. So young people in particular, you can't just get one shot and then not get your second shot get your shot at all.
And in particular, the booster shots that we've been hearing a lot about in the news, right now the only people who are eligible for those are those who are immunocompromised or immunosuppressed. The CDC and FDA are expected to rule in the coming month on booster shots for everybody else. So probably about the middle of September, that'll be made available, but it's not available yet. But the emerging data is showing that those booster shots do help a lot with protection, especially after 8 months, after your second shot.
Yeah, the statistics on that are, with the two shots of the Pfizer vaccine, you get about a 91% protection, and with a single shot of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, you get about 72% efficacy. And the efficacy of a second shot for the J&J vaccine is still being studied. But this week, J&J said that a booster shot at 6 months can boost your antibodies 9 times higher than the first shot. And Pfizer said that a booster between 5 and 8 months after your second shot can triple your antibodies. And this is really important, particularly for older people and people with weakened immune systems or younger folks with comorbidities. So that's going to be really important once they submit the paperwork to the FDA and get approval for that.
Yeah. And we're hearing that the Biden administration is really leaning on the FDA and the CDC to approve the booster shots as quickly as possible. They really want to expedite it because the particularly with schools reopening, you know, that's a looming catastrophe in much of the country.
Mm-hmm. Now I want to do a little, some straight talk here about the risks that people who are not fully vaccinated have, the real risk. Okay. People who are not fully vaccinated are 4 times more likely to catch COVID-19. They're 4 times more likely to die of it and 9 times more likely to be hospitalized with serious illness. And as, and you know, on this program, you have at least 2 people who have been in the hospital and one of us who's been in the hospital a lot. And we can both say that being in the hospital is not fun, is not something you want to sign up for.
Especially when you know there are people with COVID on the same floor.
Yeah, and you may need to lay on a mat on the floor if the hospital fills up, okay? Or a gurney in a hallway somewhere. And you do not want to do that. Now, if you haven't gotten the shot because you don't want to take time off from work or your busy life, think about this. If you test positive for COVID-19, you'll have to stay home in isolation for at least 10 days. Okay, so that's going to take a chunk of time out of your work, right? If you end up in the hospital with a serious case, you can expect your very expensive hospital stay to last from 3 days to up to 2 weeks or more. Okay, and you could be out of work for weeks or months while you recover, if you recover. And when you see that hospital bill, you may wish you hadn't recovered. Okay, I was in the hospital overnight just about 3 years ago for something different than COVID-19. And without insurance, that one night in the hospital would have cost me more than $20,000. Okay, with insurance, I ended up paying $2,300 for a one-night stay in the hospital. So think about that. The vaccine is free. You'll be a little sick for 24 hours and then you're done. Okay. So those are the arguments. If you're vaccinated and you know somebody who's not vaccinated, you have that straight talk with them. Okay. That's the argument that's going to make them think again, what the real cost is if you get sick with COVID-19. We're not even talking about you feeling bad or maybe you'll just feel a little ill versus maybe you'll be seriously ill. We're talking about the real cost, the financial cost to them of losing 10 days off from work and of potentially having to pay tens of thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars for their treatment if they don't have insurance, but literally tens of thousands if they do. Okay? So that's the trade-off.
Yeah, and if you know a Seattle police officer, talk to them because apparently large numbers of SPD officers are not vaccinated. And we heard from the ever helpful Mike Solon, the head of Seattle Police Officers Guild this week, who is predicting that once the October 18th deadline for any public employees in the state of Washington to get vaccinated came around, the city would be forced to terminate large numbers of its officers who were refusing to get vaccinated. Now,
oh boy.
Good riddance.
I shouldn't be laughing, but no, hey, because, you know, it begs the question.
What part of public safety did these cops not understand? You know, what happened to the protect part of serve and protect? You know, it really, and there are large numbers of officers also who have been claiming on, you know, medical or religious grounds that they can't wear a mask. The city does not have exact numbers on that. It did send out a survey called an attestation that they'd gotten vaccinated. This was back in July before the city and state mandates came into effect. Only about 20% of SPD officers said they had been vaccinated. Now, that's a survey, which means not everybody responded. So that probably is not an accurate number. But it gives you a sense of how low the number actually is, probably. It's comparable to what we're seeing in the U.S. South. And we've seen how that's worked out. So, you know, it really, and given that officers in the course of their workday routinely come into close contact with a lot of people, you know, these are super spreaders all on their own.
Yeah, and many of them are unwilling to wear masks.
Yeah,
So unvaccinated, not wearing a mask, and out there risking other people's lives. I mean, they don't even really have to carry a gun, right?
They are carrying a gun at a molecular level. But yeah, it's really a bad scene, and it underscores how poorly Chief Diaz and the city of Seattle have control of SPD. This has been legally mandated and they're not getting compliance. And you've got the head of the police union saying openly, well, they're not going to comply, so you're just going to have to fire them. And he's saying that not because he wants them to be fired, but because he wants the city and state to back off or somehow give police officers an exemption because they're holier than holy or something. It's not really clear, but it is a clear and present danger to public welfare right now, even more so than SPD usually is.
Yeah, so that kind of leaves me speechless in some ways, but probably shouldn't surprise me too much, because the police unions seldom take direction from anyone. But in this case, they're basically pushing back and saying, hey, let us set city policy, not the mayor and city council.
Or the state. Yeah.
And it
really underscores the cultural rot within SPD, which has been a problem for decades and has not really been addressed by the reform process so far. It also underscores how important the mayoral race is, because they will be picking the next police chief.
Yes. One other thing I want to add too, that is becoming a trend this week, is people who are not vaccinated may have to pay higher insurance rates. Okay. Now, some employers are instituting the employers that require employees to pay a portion of their medical premiums. Some employers are asking their employees to provide proof of vaccination, or they're going to add a higher fee to what they withhold from their check to pay for the employee portion of their health insurance premium, because people who are unvaccinated have a higher risk of going to the hospital, getting seriously ill, going to the hospital, and raising the company's overall insurance rates. So people who are unvaccinated should think about that too, particularly if you're self-employed and you haven't gotten the shot because you're just too busy, you know, to take the time off work. Think about the increase in your insurance rates, as well as the potential for lost work if you do get sick. So that's becoming more of a trend. So the FDA granted full approval to the Pfizer vaccine this week, which has led more businesses, state and city governments, and the federal government to declare a vaccine mandate for their employees. And that includes the Pentagon is now requiring everyone in the military to get vaccinated, because there's, surprise, surprise, been low compliance in the military. And a number of school districts around the nation, including here in Washington State, are requiring all employees to get vaccinated as well, which to me is kind of a shock. You would think teachers would be the first to get in line to get vaccinated, but there are now stories coming out in school districts around the country where teachers have infected almost their entire classroom. Teachers who have been sick with COVID-19 have infected large numbers in their classrooms.
There was a really bad one of an elementary school teacher in Marin County, California, who literally infected the entire first two rows of her classroom because she was unvaccinated.
And took her mask off to read aloud to the kids in the class.
Yeah.
So, not adhering to mask mandates, we're also seeing news stories of irate parents who don't want to get vaccinated and don't want to wear masks storming school district board meetings, saying, take off your masks.
Yeah. There's a bad incident of that in Wenatchee this week. And there have been several around Washington State where the school boards are just harassed by these, you know, lunatic parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bad, bad scene.
Yeah. Now, the CDC also said this week that Pfizer and Moderna are monitoring the few cases of myocarditis and pericarditis. That's inflammation of the heart muscle and the tissue surrounding the heart that have been reported in a small number of people who've received those vaccines. And it's a very, very small number. Now, the CDC also reminded us that your risk of getting both of those conditions is far greater if you get COVID-19 than if you get one of the vaccines. You get sicker when you get COVID-19 than you can get from any of the three vaccines. Okay.
And it attacks almost every system in the body. It's a remarkably resourceful virus.
Not just your heart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, of course, we're hearing a lot right now about Florida and Texas. Florida judge yesterday overturned Ron DeSantis' ban on masks in Florida schools. Over half of the population of Florida in terms of school districts had already decided to defy the governor on that. Unfortunately, DeSantis has stacked the state Supreme Court, so he is likely to win at the Supreme Court level. However, the school district has already started in much of the Sun Belt, and we're already seeing huge numbers of cases among school kids in states that do not have mandatory mask mandates, which is most of the states in that region. So in Florida, in Texas, in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina, all of these states are seeing large numbers of school kids being infected and a significant number of school kids, particularly in Florida, dying. Pediatric wards overflowing. And, you know, you can't just transfer them to adult wards because pediatric medicine is not the same as medicine for adults. Kids are not miniature adults. Depending on the body weight, how you treat them is different. The drugs you can give them is different. It's all different.
The equipment is all different, sized very differently.
Yep. So, it's a bad scene. And we're particularly seeing concern in Louisiana right now because of Hurricane Ida, because the hospitals there are already full. People cannot be moved out of the hospitals because there aren't any hospital beds in the entire region, in the entire Gulf Coast, you know, for hundreds of miles in any direction. There are no hospital beds available. So so what do you do with casualties from a Category 4 hurricane? What do you do about people who are unvaccinated and in shelters? Louisiana and Mississippi have the two lowest vaccination rates in the country right now.
Yeah, so, right around 37% to 38%. It's very, very low. That means over 60%, somewhere around 2/3 of all the adults in those two states are unvaccinated.
Yeah, which means if you're crowded in a shelter with all of them, where it's running on a generator and everybody's jammed together, or sleeping on a floor in a gymnasium next to each other, those are super spreader events. Mm-hmm. So this hurricane is, even more of an issue than usual because of COVID and because of Republican governors, and the consistent messaging from them and from Trump supporters and the disinformation on social media that the vaccines are somehow dangerous, that they're not to be trusted. And of course, with the FDA approval of the Pfizer vaccine this week, it's pivoted from, well, the FDA, hasn't approved it, therefore it must not be safe, to the FDA can't be trusted. It really is moving the goalposts regularly. We're seeing a number of instances around the country now of where a horse tranquilizer called ivermectin that has become very popular as an alleged COVID cure is making people sick all over the country. And we've even seen some elected officials touting this as a cure for COVID, which makes you pine for the old days of hydroxychloroquine, right?
Yeah, which had folks from the CDC saying this week, you are not a horse, as part of their messaging to the public of the United States. Look, you're not a horse. Don't take a horse drug.
although,
it's not formulated for you.
Although some of the elected officials may resemble part of the certain part of the anatomy of a horse. But, you know, yeah. It's,
I'm thinking not the front end.
Probably not, no.
Yeah. The fact that we have regions of the country that are not that are largely unvaccinated, and those regions are encountering what climate scientists refer to as overlapping crises, right? So a pandemic that's related to global warming, that's COVID-19. As well as a massive hurricane hitting the Gulf Coast, which these massive storms are with much more intensity and much more moisture behind them are directly related now to global warming.
Yeah,
it's kind of amazing.
We've seen, this has been an active hurricane season already and is predicted to continue to be. And we've seen this phenomenon the last couple of years. It's a relatively new phenomenon of rapid intensification. So Ida, just became a hurricane last night over western Cuba. It's already a category 2. It's supposed to be a category 4 by the time it makes landfall tomorrow. So, this is something that we saw with a couple of the hurricanes that hit Louisiana last year, as well as Fred, earlier this year and a couple of the others. So it's very much linked to climate change. COVID itself is probably linked to climate change as well. Overlapping crises. Welcome to the new normal. I should also note that, we talk a lot about the American South, and it's been a lot in the news, but some of the hardest hit counties per capita in the United States are actually in southern Oregon. They're, you know, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine County, the areas around Roseburg, Medford, Grants Pass. These areas are getting hammered. There's no hospital beds available. National Guard have been deployed to help out with overwhelmed healthcare workers. It's a very, very bad scene. It's in the Pacific Northwest. And so if you think this is something that's happening far away, you're wrong. I mean, it is happening far away, but it's happening very close to us too.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned earlier, record number of cases right now, eclipsing, last spring of 2020, eclipsing winter, this past winter, in King County and statewide. Primarily among the unvaccinated, but everybody needs to protect themselves whether they're vaccinated or not.
All right. Well, let's move on quickly. The Biden administration is taking on Facebook.
Yes, the FTC expanded an existing lawsuit this week against Facebook, seeking to break up Facebook as a monopoly. This is something that has not been tried in a long time by the federal government. They do have the power to break up monopolies, but really we haven't seen that since the old days of AT&T. That was in the late 70s, I believe. That was ordered. So it's been nearly 50 years of unfettered corporate deregulation, and we're seeing the Biden administration now saying it wants to get tough on monopolies, and the first one that it's going after is Facebook. The FTC had already sued against it because of the disinformation that it said Facebook was a conduit for, and that its algorithms tend to favor. Particularly around the COVID pandemic and past elections. But now the lawsuit is much broader, and it's seeking to literally break up Facebook. Now, legally, I don't think this has a great chance of success, but it is an interesting precedent in terms of what the Biden administration's priorities are.
I think they're thinking of breaking it up along the different things that you can do in Facebook, like the messaging versus the advertising versus the kind of social media aspect of it. Facebook is more than just the Facebook social media website now. and like companies like Google and some of those other big online tech companies, Amazon, for example, there are many, many aspects to the Facebook business now. And that's the likeliest way that it would be broken up is along the lines of all of the acquisitions that Facebook has been making to try to make it bigger than just a place you go to see photos of your friends and cat videos.
And Facebook has also been buying up competitors. It now owns WhatsApp, for instance. Mm-hmm. This is part of the FTC lawsuit as well.
Yeah.
That, one of the ways that it has gotten a virtual monopoly in social media is by buying out its competitors, which of course is a long time practice of monopolistic companies. So, they're not all of this is new.
Moving on, Austin police officer charged with murder.
Yes, and it's actually the second charge of murder that Christopher Taylor is facing. He's already been charged with a 2020 killing. Now he's being charged in addition with a shooting in 2019. And it tells you how little attention was paid to this 2019 shooting, that he was still on the force and able to kill somebody else in 2020. But that was an encouraging sign this week. Of course, this morning is the anniversary of the March on Washington, and they're having another rally in Washington, D.C. in March, primarily focused on police killings. That issue is not going away, and it's not going to go away.
Just a couple minutes left. Do you want to talk about the California fires?
Let's talk about Afghanistan.
All right.
It was a busy week in Afghanistan. And interestingly enough, the reprisal drone attack last night, which happened very quickly. The Pentagon was literally saying yesterday that it was developing a target list for ISIS-K. And lo and behold, CENTCOM comes out and says, well, we killed one of the planters last night. Now, there's not necessarily much transparency around that, other than listing the province. They haven't identified who the victim is, whether there were any ancillary casualties, et cetera, what the exact location was, et cetera, et cetera. It does tell you that the Biden administration is serious about trying to set an example that the world is watching about what it will do if anybody else attacks U.S. soldiers or tries to attack the U.S. itself.
I find it kind of interesting that the drone campaign of assassinating folks who are suspected terrorists without a whole lot of public transparency continues from where it started under the George W. Bush candidacy, went straight through the Obama presidency, and he expanded the program, survived the Trump administration, and is now still going on through the Biden administration.
Yeah. When government gets a handy new power that's not very accountable, it rarely tends to give it up. We mm-hmm. saw this with the expansion of the imperial presidency under Bush, that Obama took that and ran with it. He didn't disavow any of it, and neither is Biden.
That's true.
And really, the only body that would be capable of reining that in would be Congress, and Congress isn't capable of much these days.
All right.
Oh.
I told you it'd be 55 minutes of bad news.
All right. I'll talk to you both same time next week.
Sounds good. I'll be here.